So, why are we here? Really, it's because proof of work is a fascinating phenomenon, and it has a variety of different applications. I think most of us here are familiar with using it, of course, for mining, for securing proof of work consensus networks. But, you know, proof of work is a technology that's existed for, I think, about 30 years. And it's only really in the past decade or so, I think, started to get more acceptance and understanding. And it's the understanding aspect which I, as a researcher, find particularly interesting. So, you know, when I was asked to come here talk about proof of work, I wasn't entirely sure what I was going to talk about because over the years, there's a number of different things that I found interesting. And when I looked back, this is just from my own blog. I found at least 10 different essays and research pieces that I've done over the past decade that I've tagged with proof of work or mining. Most of them investigating the Bitcoin network, various aspects of block creation and hash rate distribution and historical aspects of mining. Though you'll see in 2021, I used proof of work on my own website, and I use it to stop all of the stupid spam bots that are trying to use my contact form to send me advertisements and stuff that I don't want. And it works pretty well for that. But there are so many aspects of this technology and its application that I think merit further exploration. And proof of work, I think, was interesting from Satoshi's perspective. You know, Satoshi talked about it in a few different ways as, you know, proof of work is a solution to synchronizing essentially the decimation of data. It's how do we take a piece of data and somehow modify it or alter it or give it this characteristic of integrity so that we can then share that data out with the world without a care for which intermediaries, which third parties may have handled that data at some point. As Satoshi said, proof of work has this really nice property that it can be relayed through untrusted middlemen. And so, you know, the proof of work is its own self-contained piece of integrity. It's great. It is a very simple mathematical construct where you take that data, you run very simple algorithmic computation on it, and you can be ensured that it has not been tampered with and that someone has put a decent amount of energy and expended, you know, that effort to put the data out there into the world. Now, personally, one of the things that I've been doing a lot of research into and what I'll talk about in this talk is the difficulty in measuring proof of work. And this gets into the mechanics of essentially the, you know, Poisson distribution of your expected output from a given proof. These things are probabilistic. They're not perfect in the sense that you can't look at a proof of work and know exactly how much time, money, cost, CPU cycles were put into that proof, but you can get a generally good idea. And the reason that these proof of work networks work so well is that when you scale that up to a global network to tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of machines around the world that are all working in concert, then with the law of averages, you know, these distributions work out quite nicely. But if you're looking at one particular proof, you can't really know what went into it. And so it's this measurement problem that I found very interesting. So I think of proof of work as the wind, as a natural phenomenon where it's out there. We know that there are a ton of miners out there mining these different proof of work networks, but we can't truly know, we can't precisely measure the amount of electricity and the amount of computational cycles that are going into these proofs. But I wondered, you know, how close can we get to truly knowing, to accurately being able to measure the global network hash rate. And so I will specifically talk about delving into trying to understand the Bitcoin hash rate. And I think much of what I will be talking about is applicable to other proof-of-work networks, though there's some caveats, mainly around the data collection. So, you know, the details here of how you estimate proof-of-work when you're given a proof and you want to know how much work went into it, the specifics aren't really important. You don't need to know this. But as I said, it's a pretty simple mathematical formula where you can look at the known difficulty target for a given block. You can know, you know, this is like the number of leading zeros in the proof that were required to be valid. You can kind of work backwards from there to say, okay, you know, if the difficulty was this much, then we expect that somewhere around this amount of work would have to be put into it. And then the most important thing I think to take away from this is that the variable that goes into estimating global network hash rate, global level of work being performed, is the number of trailing blocks, really. How long of a time window are you looking at to then figure out this sort of aggregate average of total number of, you know, expected hashes being performed over a given amount of time? And thankfully, we don't have to actually do any of this math by hand. You know, if you're running a node, for example, you can just run this, you know, get network hash per second, give it a few parameters, and that does the hard work for you. If you're going around looking at different websites that tell you what the global network hash rate is for Bitcoin, and then you try to line them up on the same chart, you may notice that they don't actually line up. And that's because these different websites are not using the same algorithm, or in many cases, they're using a different number of trailing blocks, a different time range over which they're doing that calculation from the last slide to try to make this estimate. And this can be problematic if you want to, you know a real accurate hash rate. Hash rate index is one of the, you know, premier sites, I think, out there that has some good research and good thought pieces around the particular estimates and why you should use them. And from their perspective, they believe that the 7-day trailing estimate is a pretty good approximation. You can see here, it's pretty smooth, it's not too volatile. It looks like a pretty nice chart. Kraken, a couple of years ago, put out a white paper for something that they called the true hash rate. Unfortunately, what they did not converge upon a specific algorithm that they thought would give you the best and most accurate hash rate. Rather, what they did is they took the daily, like 140 block estimate, and they would then use a 30-day rolling average of each of those daily estimates, find the standard deviation for that, and then what you see, so that's the actual volatile chart, is that daily hash rate. And then what they would do is they would find that standard deviation, which is the blue shaded area, and they would calculate what they considered to be the 95% confidence band of what the true global hash rate was. Unfortunately, this, as you can see, is nearly like a 40% in either way potential deviation. So I would say if you're calling that a confidence range, I would not be very confident about picking any particular number in that range. So what did I do? I basically started trying to understand this myself. And so one of the first things I did, this is from a blog post that I published a few months ago, is I just started writing a bunch of scripts to output many, many different hash rate estimates across different time ranges. And so, you know, for simplicity and the ability to give you some nice charts that are somewhat legible, here we have 10 block, 50 block, 100 block, 1,000 block, and 10,000 block estimates. We can see that it's highly volatile if you're only using the past 10 blocks, which is about 2 hours worth of data. But once you get up to around a three-day, 400, 500 block time frame, that starts to smooth out a bit more. But the downside is these shorter time frames can have more distortion, more volatility, and they can make the hash rate appear a lot higher or a lot lower than it really is. So I think it's generally agreed that the 7-day around the 1,000 block hash rate is a pretty good mixture between getting that volatility and getting something that is a bit more predictable and accurate. The problem, though, as you can see, if you go out to like 10,000 blocks, if you go out to multiple weeks, while that is smoother, it's always going to be off by more, and that's because you start lagging whatever the real hash rate is. Because if you think about it, there's lots of miners out there that are constantly adding machines to this network. So you're going to start to be several weeks behind whatever that real hash rate is. Now, one of the interesting and I think novel things that I stumbled upon is that there is a way for us to start to get a better idea of what the actual accuracy of these things is. Now, the goal, I think, if you're doing hash rate estimates, is you need to be only working off the data that is available to you in the blockchain, that's publicly available to everyone. The problem with that is you have no external source that you can really check it against. And what I found earlier this year is that Brains, mining pool, has actually started to collect what they call the real-time hash rate. And essentially, for the past couple of years, what they've been doing is every few minutes, they ping every mining pool's API out there, and they get back whatever the self-reported hash rate from that mining pool is. Thankfully, the folks at Brains were kind enough to give me a full data dump of the data they had collected. It was pretty messy. I had to write a bunch of scripts to normalize the data and essentially chunk it into blocks. And so I got this chart of what I ended up with the aggregate from all of these pools being. And I put that against the like 3-day hash rate. And very quickly discovered that for the first year or so of this data set, it's very wrong. So my suspicion is that they were not collecting it from all of the mining pools. But we can see that after that first year, it actually starts to line up pretty well. So it looks like they got to the point where they, in fact, were collecting data from all of the public mining pools. So this, in particular the blue line, this is what I have been using as my sort of baseline, like real hash rate that I can then perform various calculations upon to try to figure out how well these purely blockchain data-based hash rate estimates are performing. So I started calculating things like error rates. And as we can see here, the one block estimate is insanely wrong. You can be 60,000% off from whatever the real network hash rate is. And this is, of course, essentially when a miner gets lucky and they find a block a few seconds after the last one. Obviously, that's not because the hash rate just went up by 60,000%. It's just luck. It has to do with the distribution of winning and finding these lottery numbers, as it were. So we know we're going to throw that out. In fact, you can't even really see the error rate. So we'll zoom in some more. So 10 block estimates, they're getting better. We're getting down to an error rate range within 300-400%. That's still pretty bad. That's still worse than that Kraken true hash rate that they did back in 2020. Let's zoom in some more. We get down to 50 blocks, and we're under 100% average error rates. But it's really, I think, you can see some nice striations here. Once we get into the 500 block range, you know, half a week of data that we're starting to estimate, we can actually start to get under 10%. We're into single-digit error rates. So if we just sort of plot that all out, what is, you know, the average hash rate estimate error rate for this particular year-long data set that I was working on? Then it's pretty obvious, I think, from this chart, you know, the further out you go, the better your error rate gets. But thankfully, I did not stop at 1,000 blocks because, as I said, you get to a point where you start lagging behind the real hash rate by too much. So it gets interesting when you look at the 1,000 to 2,000 block estimates. And we can see here, eventually, you know, you get around the 1,200 block, you know, more than a week of data, and the error rate starts ticking up again. And this is because you are too far behind. So what we can see is there's a sweet spot. Somewhere in the 1,100 to 1,150 block range of trailing data will give us the best estimate. And similar type of thing, if we look at the standard deviation, it pretty much matches up in terms of, you know, trying to find the optimal amount of data to use. So an average error rate of under 4% with a standard deviation of under 3 exahash per second if you're using this 1,100 to 1,150 block trailing data, that's not bad. But I wondered, could we do better? You know, what if we could blend the accuracy of those long-range, week-long estimates with the faster reaction speed and volatility of the shorter range estimates? And so I did some initial test runs where I just wrote a script where all it did was blend the 100 block estimate with the 1100 block estimate, and it iterated through a bunch of combinations of three different variables. One of those was looking at the different estimates for a number of the trailing blocks, the previous blocks before that block, really anywhere from 10 to 100 previous blocks worth of estimates. And then a variable of weighting the shorter term estimate if it was higher than the long term estimate, and a variable of weighting the shorter term estimate if it was lower than the long-term estimate. I was basically using this long-term estimate as a baseline. So that would be the red line being the long-term estimate, and the 100 block is the yellow line, and of course blue is the quote-unquote real hash rate, but that's not even used in any of this. You know, we can't actually rely upon that or use that as a data set. And since this script tries so many different permutations, it took several days to run. I actually parallelized it, and the output ended up with about 5 million different data points. But from each run, where I was essentially looking at 10 range trailing block ranges here, I found some interesting patterns, basically that weighing the short range estimate at about 20% seemed to give the most accurate error rates and standard deviations for that given range. But of course, I only did up to about 100 trailing blocks for that first run. So we can see here, this was actually a failure. You know, we're trying to beat that 1150 or 1120 block estimate, which has an average error rate of 3.8% and standard deviation of 2.95 exahash. None of these even got close to that. So we haven't found a strictly better algorithm yet, but we can see some trends. So what did I decide to do next? Really, I said, okay, we need to do even more blending of more hash rate estimates. So for my next run, I blended 10 different estimates, basically 100 block, 200 block, 300 block, all the way up to 1,000 block estimates. And my script was a little bit more complex. I basically said, you know, if any of these estimates is more than one standard deviation away from the baseline 1,100 block estimate, then I would give that a 10% weight. Otherwise, I would give 10% weight to the long-term estimate. I also tried setting some cutoff thresholds for these shorter-term estimates, where if it was lower than the baseline, I would throw them out. I quickly discovered from trying a bunch of different weights that the greatest accuracy improvement came from throwing out all of the short-term estimates that were lower than the baseline estimate. And I think this is because the general trend for the hash rate is up. So almost always, if your estimate is going down, it's almost always wrong. So from that, I actually ended up settling upon an algorithm that had an average error rate of 3.495% with a standard deviation of 2.69. So this was a slight improvement. So sort of takeaways here, most websites are publishing one-day estimates, which have about 6.7 average percent rate in their error. The savvier sites are using three-day averages, which are a little better. The best sites should use that seven-day average, which has less than a 4% error rate. And I managed to find a slight optimization here where I improved upon that seven-day average trailing estimate by 13% on the error rate and 14% on the standard deviation. And you know, this was just from spending a few days and writing some scripts that took a few days to run. I think there is still plenty of room for improvement in future work. There are, of course, some assumptions here. You know, I only had 1 year of data to work with. We're assuming that those pools are honestly reporting whatever their true hash rate is. I would say from looking at the data, it looks like they are fairly honest. It's also assuming the pools don't share hash rate with each other, which I think is probably pretty minimal. Now, the algorithm that I came up with is technically more computationally complex, but it's only about 10 times more complex, and we're still talking milliseconds, really, to calculate that. This, as I said, it should be applicable to most other proof-of-work networks, but it would be problematic if you're trying to run it against a network that is quote-unquote ASIC-resistant, aka networks that are changing their hashing algorithm on a regular basis, because that's, of course, just going to reset everything. And I think the main things that we can look for to improve upon this are just waiting longer to collect more data. That will obviously improve our accuracy and allow us to have algorithms that are better able to handle things like, for example, the China ban, when we saw half of the network hash rate just disappear over the matter of a few weeks. And I think the real potential improvement here, this seems like the type of problem that should be great for machine learning, because what we're trying to do is we're trying to find the optimal number of different parameters and variables that we can tweak to hone in on what the most accurate hash rate estimate would be. So this is just sort of me nerding out. I do this a lot on all types of different aspects of Bitcoin, and welcome really any insights or questions if you want to talk about proof of work or really anything else related to this ecosystem.
So my first question is we have approximately in March of next year, our next halvening. Mm-hmm. What do you anticipate seeing in hash rate pre and direct post halvening?
Yeah, the interesting thing about the halving is that it's very well known, right? The miners are hurtling towards this full steam ahead, and we've seen, over the past year, hash rate going crazy. So, the miners are not stupid. They're doing all their profitability calculations. They're already calculating what they expect their profitability will be after the halving. So I think we can definitely anticipate it's going to keep zooming upward until the point of the halving. At that point, sure, there will definitely be some of the less profitable miners that have to drop off the network, but I would be willing to bet it'll be fairly negligible.
Okay. So definitely we've got some questions from nerds in the room. All right, cool. Run out here. Looks like we have about 2-3 questions. Donald.
Thank you. Thank you, Lau. Very good presentation. What is the use case of knowing the hash rate more accurately for Bitcoin, Ethereum Classic, or Litecoin? What are people using it today, for example? And why would it be better for it to be more exact?
Yeah, you know, there's not necessarily, I think, a financial incentive. You know, if you're a miner and you're trying to understand what you're competing against, then you may be interested in having a little bit better accuracy. But, you know, one of the reasons why I started looking into this is simply because I just started getting annoyed by a lot of the sort of influencer accounts out there publishing stuff like, you know, Bitcoin network hash rate hit 500 exahash or whatever. Because most of the time, and this happens for many different aspects in the space, but, you know, people will post a data point and they won't talk about how they actually achieved that or what the assumptions were around it. So for me, it's really just about converging upon a standard just to try to reduce the noise. Like when we're trying to talk about something, if we're not all operating off of the same assumptions, then we're going to start yelling at each other, talking past each other, and it's just a waste of time. So I primarily see this as just a way of us trying to converge on a consensus for this one particular way of, you know, viewing these networks.
Cool. Next question is from Kerry Washington.
Hey, Jameson. So you had the data from this company that you said the first year or two, it was noisy.
Yeah.
And so I'm really curious about, first of all, was it because of you that you got the data? And second, did you have a discussion with them about, well, those first 2 years were basically garbage, right? I had to look at them the third year. So I'd love to hear what you thought about that and if you had a conversation. Yeah,
a little bit. Like I was lucky, and you know, probably the fact that it was me helped. You know, from my understanding, you know, Brains, they started collecting this just out of interest. Like they haven't really been doing much with it. If you go to the Brains mining pool dashboard, you can see the current real-time hash rate that is the aggregate of what's being reported from all the pools. What they have not done any historical analysis. So basically, they had all this data just sitting in the database, but it's currently not exposed in any way for the average person to consume. So I did have to politely ask, hey, can you give me this, you know, JSON data dump? And then I had to write my own tooling to better understand it. And so I think it was just because this was just a sort of side interest thing that they weren't trying to monetize or do anything with, that it was a piecemeal type of function where over time they were slowly adding more and more mining pools out there. And so eventually they got to the point where they had effectively all of the hash rate. But, you know, this is a trusted third-party data source, right? I have no way of verifying the numbers that they gave me, because no one else, as far as I'm aware of, has been collecting those numbers. So, you know, if this is something that the community or some subset of other entities in the space is interested in, it would be great if we had multiple distributed entities that were all consuming this data, storing it, and then we could, you know, cross-check with each other to converge upon an even more reliable measure of the, like, real-time network hash rate.
Cool. Next up is Cypherpunk, the real Nick Laws.
I love you, Michael. Thank you for the work, Jameson. That's lovely statistical work. My question is more about the distribution of hash rates, because we ever so often see pie charts where it's like, this pool has more, this pool has less. So could your work give us more clarity about the distribution of hash rate globally? And is there a way to potentially distribute this or decentralize this? Thank you.
I think the hash rate distribution, that would come more into looking at the real-time hash rate. You know, all of my stuff was looking at aggregates, and when you're looking at aggregates, you know, you're really based off of only the blocks that are being reported. There are different ways, I guess, to look at the blocks in the blockchain, to look for the tags from the different mining pools. And that's a pretty well understood, I think, operation. There's a number of different entities out there that will consume those tags and give you those pie charts. So I would say that, you know, the pool hash rate distribution is, you can rely upon that fairly well, though it is subject to the same issues that I just talked about, where it's based on, you know, how many trailing blocks they're looking at. But I think usually the 3-day and the 7-day are the most common for what we see with those pie charts. But yeah, I mean, I thought it was interesting when Bob showed the chart about how China banning Bitcoin was actually good for the sort of pollution aspect of Bitcoin. It was also good for the global geographic distribution of hash rate. However, what we've seen is that the sort of the center of the world of hash rate has moved from China to America. So we've just sort of moved the problem over. So sure, America is a somewhat less authoritarian state than China. You could probably argue that it's better to have more hash rate in America, but the optimal hash rate distribution, I believe, is for it to be distributed around the world, you know, get as much jurisdictional and regulatory arbitrage as possible. And my optimistic view on that is that that is inevitable over the long term, and that's because energy is widely distributed. So I am hopeful that, you know, 10 years from now, we will see hash rate even more widely distributed than it is today, and that will be good for Bitcoin.
So I have one final question that's more for the live stream than it is for this room, although it might possibly be relevant. You're primarily known as a Bitcoiner, and we're here at a Proof of Work Summit, which includes Ethereum, and which includes Litecoin, one of our earliest proof-of-work forks. Do you think, as someone that's prominent in this space, that there is room for other proof-of-work coins besides Bitcoin, mm-hmm. and why?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what we've seen, especially from the early days, you know, the first 3, 4, or 5 years of the, like, altcoin space, a lot of the innovation back then was literally just like changing the proof of work algorithm. So on one hand, I believe that like the average cryptocurrency user doesn't care at all what the hash rate algorithm is that's securing the network. They don't think about it. It's not important to them. It is important to the network itself, of course. But what we've seen is that this is kind of a winner-take-all type of environment in the context of a specific hash rate algorithm. There can only be one king of SHA-256. There can only be one king of Equihash, whatever, especially if it's the type of algorithm that is implemented with ASICs. And this is because you end up having all of these other networks that, just due to the difficulty in bootstrapping networks and network effects, like the number two network is very rarely even half the size, value, and therefore computational difficulty of the number one network, which means all of the other networks that aren't number one for whatever their hash rate algorithm is are going to be perpetually at risk of 51% attack. So, you know, good examples of this for SHA-256, of course, Bitcoin Cash, Bitcoin SV, the other 50 Bitcoin forks that use SHA-256. They're all trivially attackable, really. If you got a single Bitcoin mining pool that wanted to, they could just demolish those other things. Why doesn't that happen? I think, an interesting question of game theory, and probably the fact that it's just not even worth the time and effort for this to happen. But they do remain under perpetual threat, and we have seen stuff. Actually, I think BSV has been 51% attacked a few times, and most people didn't even notice because nobody uses it. But it's an ongoing
I always see it sort of like, you know, old classic car clubs, right? There's some guy with a 1954 Turkish Fiat, a Tofaş, and he will keep that thing running, you know, four generations. And I sort of like think that chains will never die. I see that there will always be some hobbyist that's got five computers at home in the basement and a friend in another country, and they'll keep the network going, sort of thing. Yep. Jameson Lopp, man, thank you so much for the subtle branding.
Uh-huh.